Blog Talk Radio.
Tonight, the moment has arrived. The movie geeks welcome one of the most gifted and accomplished filmmakers of our time, Mr. Paul Schrader. Plus, the director of the new film Married Life, starring Pierce Brosnan and Chris Cooper, Mr. Ira Sachs. Then, just days following its premiere at this year's Method Fest, writer-director Daniel Davila will tell us about his new film, Harrison Montgomery, starring Martin Landau. It's a big, big two-hour show coming up next on Movie Geeks United. Hello out there. Welcome to Movie Geeks United, this great Sunday evening edition of Movie Geeks United.
Welcome.
My name is Jamie. Yes, and the voice you just heard, that's Jerry. How you doing, man?
I'm doing good. How are you doing?
Good. I'm a little nervous. I mean, you and I have spoken about this.
Yes, we have. We've been talking about it all day, all week. We've been talking about it for weeks.
A little on edge, a little nervous.
A little nervous, but...
This is one of the wow moments of our show. You know?
Yes.
I'm just hoping I can contain the quivering voice thing. Does that happen to you when you get nervous?
Yes. It happens, I'll be very honest with you. Until last Wednesday's show was the first night I felt really comfortable talking to our guests.
Right.
And
right,
it really
right.
broke through.
It was a very comfortable, relaxed show
yeah.
last Wednesday. Mm-hmm. For those of you who aren't aware, we had a two-hour tribute show to Mr. Schrader. On Wednesday, we had a roster of great guests, and I'm just crazy about that show, and we've had so many great comments from the show, and we appreciate that. I don't know if anyone out there realizes you can rate the shows that you're particularly fond of and leave comments, and we've had some great ratings, great comments. We also had a comment that said something like, the Japanese's is making good movies too, which brings up another point. If you leave a comment, make sure that we can understand it.
Yeah.
I think that's important.
We don't ask a lot. We really don't.
That was a little odd, that comment. But we couldn't be more thrilled and honored to bring you this show tonight. We're going to be taking a couple of weeks off. We will have a show on Sunday, but we're taking the next two Wednesdays and the Sunday following off to prepare for our one-year anniversary show on Wednesday, April 16th. It's going to be a lot of fun, over an hour's worth of clips from over 180 interviews we've done in the past year with some just exceptional talent, exceptionally inspiring people. We're going to have a listener call-ins and giveaways. I hope everyone can tune in. That's going to be a wonderful, fun show.
Yes, it will.
And thanks, everyone, for joining us in the chat room. If you're not logged into the chat room yet, go ahead and do so. You can submit questions through that form there, and Jerry will be monitoring it throughout the show. You can also call into our show at 718-508-9477. Our guest is on the line. You ready to get started, Jerry?
Let's do it.
Let's do it. The movie geeks are thrilled to welcome one of our great cinematic heroes to the show tonight. Anyone who listened in on last week's special tribute to this gentleman heard words like challenging, unflinching, tough, big-hearted. These are just a few words that describe both the man and his resume of exceptional works, a breathtaking resume that includes screenplays for Taxi Driver, Raging Bull, The Last Temptation of Christ, The Mosquito Coast, Bringing Out the Dead, and directorial efforts like Blue Collar, Hardcore, Affliction, Autofocus, American Gigolo, Light of Day, and Cat People. And film after film, his keen understanding of drama and his daring and insightful views on the human condition leave no doubt that you are in the hands of a great artist. His recent film, The Walker, starring Woody Harrelson, hits DVD on May 27th. Criterion is currently prepping a gorgeous rendering of his 1985 classic, Mishima, A Life in Four Chapters, for a June 24th release. He has a brand new website at paulschrader.org, where you can find his resume of great works, as well as a comprehensive library from his early work as a film critic. And you can catch his next film, Adam Resurrected, with Jeff Goldblum and Willem Dafoe. I believe, we'll verify this later this year, it is truly a great honor to welcome someone who has given so much to the world of cinema and to film fans all around the globe, Mr. Paul Schrader. Mr. Schrader, are you with us?
Yes, I am.
Thank you so much for being here. I can't tell you how honored we are to have you.
Yes, welcome.
I'm talking to Jamie.
And Jerry.
I am Jamie, and Jerry's here with me.
All right. Where are you, in like Mumbai or something?
No.
We're actually at different locations. It's the magic of the internet. I am in Florida. Jerry's in Maryland, and our show was given a New York number.
So
there you go. There you have it. I wanted to start out by talking to you about. I know that you weren't. It's written. It's common knowledge that you weren't allowed to see films growing up. But were you at least exposed to the art of storytelling at a young age that sparked some kind of creative ambition?
Yeah,
in you?
Well, it wasn't just me. It was our entire church. So I didn't know anybody who saw movies, so I didn't exactly feel deprived because movies were outside of our realm of experience.
Sure.
Which, actually looking back, wasn't a bad thing at all, since it forced us to rely on an older and perhaps better form of storytelling, which is the kind around the kitchen table.
Yeah.
And my relatives, my uncles in particular, were great storytellers. And so I remember as a kid just sitting around listening to these kind of endless yarns and being captivated by it. And you know, to be honest, you know, that's probably a better training than watching endless episodes of CSI where the same plots are recycled.
Right.
Until finally, when you get to be 22 years old, you've now seen 20,000 hours of narrative, and there's nothing left to entrance you.
Yeah.
Very true.
But did you feel a need to write at a young age? Did you write a lot as a youngster?
I wanted to get it out there. So the first fantasy, of course, was to be a minister. And so I went door to door, and I was one of those kids who would bug you door to door and give you leaflets and ask about the condition of your soul. And then I lost its attraction, and I read about Clarence Darrow. I thought, oh, that's what I can be. But then, of course, I realized I couldn't get along with people well enough. and that only left being a writer, where you didn't even have to get along with people. And so I started writing basically journalism, and then luckily enough, along comes 1966, and that whole world explodes, and being a journalist is all of a sudden being politically active, and it was a very exciting time.
But correct me if I'm wrong, but I think I recall reading a quote from you where you said that if you had to choose over again, you might not necessarily pick cinema as your art form of choice. You know, is there something limiting about filmmaking find?
A slight misquote.
Okay.
Oh, okay.
If I had to choose back then, I would make the same choice. If I had to choose today, I would not choose movies, because I think movies are over. But that's another discussion, probably one that your listeners don't want to hear.
No, we can get into that.
That's a huge conversation there. Maybe we'll save that one for a little while, but I am definitely interested in exploring that some before we let you go. But your early days in film criticism and your relationship with Pauline Kael, who we're also crazy about on this show, the impression I get from her is she kind of was as she wrote. She was funny, challenging, and acerbic, but kind of hard to resist. Is that how you found her?
Yeah, I mean, she was tough, you know.
Yeah.
And she sort of plucked me out of nowhere. I was taking some summer courses at Columbia. I'd taken some time off from Calvin College, my college, because I hadn't seen any movies, and I was getting interested in movies. And, of course, we didn't show movies at Calvin. So I spent a summer at Columbia. And through meeting somebody in a bar at night who happened to know her, and the next thing I know, I'm in her apartment, and the next thing I know, I'm staying over on her couch because we talked all night long, and the next thing I know, the next morning, she's saying to me, we're going to stay in touch, and you're not going to be a minister, you're going to be a film critic.
Wow.
So that sort of turned my life around, and she got me into UCLA grad film school, and you know, without that kind of serendipitous meeting, I certainly wouldn't be doing what I'm doing now.
Well, looking through your website and reading some of those early reviews, they're just fantastic, and much like Pauline Kael's work that we're all so in awe of. But today it seems a little different. I mean, do you sense less and less relevance or merit in the film criticism of today? It's more like Consumer Reports today. But
well,
you've
touched on a pretty big subject.
Yeah.
And, you know, why has, you know, the horse of movies fallen down? You know, and there's four legs on that horse, and one of them is audiences, and one is critics, and one is filmmakers, and one is financiers.
Right.
And when that horse falls down, one leg can't get it standing up again.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, the collapse of relevant film criticism, and it's not a total collapse. There's still a lot of good people out there.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
But the importance of criticism is just mirrored by the collapse in all the other sectors. You know, movies simply do not have the place in our society that they did 20, 30 years ago.
Yeah.
You know, they've been relatively marginalized. And that is just a product of changing times, but also, more importantly, changing media.
Mm-hmm. Well, now that we've touched on this a second time, let's go ahead and explore it.
I'm dying to hear this.
Yeah, this is the elephant in the room.
Yeah.
Now everything comes in kind of waves. I mean, the new Hollywood, the Hollywood Renaissance, of which you were such a critical part in the 70s. Do you think that we'll ever get to that place again, or do you think it's point of no return that we're at?
No, that's gone. You know, what's interesting about the moment we find ourselves in now is that when I came into films, late 60s, it was a moment of crisis, but it was a crisis of content. People didn't know what movies were about. They realized they couldn't be about what they used to be about, but what were they about? And then people started making films about different things. You know, along came Easy Rider, along came Last Picture Show, and all of a sudden you realize that you can make films about these subjects. And it changed the American film industry. And it ushered in, actually, a very wonderful period of filmmaking. We're in a similar period of crisis now. Unfortunately, the nature of the crisis is not what movies are about, but what are movies.
Mm.
We no longer know what movies are. We don't know how long they are. We don't know where you watch them. You don't know whether you interact with them. You don't know whether they have narrative or not. I mean,
right.
And it's very exciting creatively, but movies are morphing into something else. And like yesterday I went to the movies, and I saw The Bank Job, and I saw three movies. I saw Boleyn Girl, and then I saw Paranoid Park.
Mm-hmm.
And it was the last movie. I said, well, there's a movie that was made now. You know, that's sort of what's happening now.
Right.
And so we are trying to figure out what the movies are. The producer of the film before my last film, who had produced 10 films, has left the producing business and now has a website where he has contests and he makes 3-minute movies for cell phones.
Mm,
this is a guy with a whole string of credits.
Right.
Yeah.
And that's how big the paradigm shift we're facing is right now. And it is kind of fascinating. I just finished the script, and it had a lot of kind of sexual material. It was about 3 nights in the life of an escort and her driver. And I thought to myself, I was going to write it feature length, and I was going to write it R-rated, because that's the tradition I come from.
Right.
And I thought, wait a second, why am I making this R? There is no R anymore. You know, theaters are on their way out.
Right.
Why don't I just make it hardcore? Because that's what the material is. I mean, it's about a girl who goes into assignations all night long. But why don't you just write what's happening? And why does it have to be an hour and a half, 2 hours? Maybe it's 320 minutes. And so I wrote this script, and it ended up being 320 minutes, and it ended up being unrated. And I thought, well, we'll make it for $400,000, and and it's a very kind of a cheap movie, and we'll set up a website and we'll sell it on the web. So if that's happening to me, and God knows, you know, I'm an old fart. If that's what's going on in my head, you can imagine what's going on in the heads of people who are, you know, 40 years younger than I am.
Yeah. Well, you're talking about this influx of new media, but how movies as we have known them are kind of losing their identity.
Right.
But doesn't it open up a flood of new options, and do you sense that movies no longer matter? Is that part of what you're sensing?
Well, audiovisual entertainment is, you know, in our bloodstreams. Mm-hmm. And as hard as it is for someone of my generation to conceive of a movie being watched on a cell phone in 3-minute segments, that may be part of the new mix of what AV is. And maybe that word AV will start to replace the word movies.
Mm-hmm.
Because movies we think of as a 2-hour experience you sit in the theater and watch in the dark.
Yeah,
and time is not on the side of the movies, but it will always be on the side of storytelling, and as storytelling has progressed now as an audiovisual medium.
Yeah, yeah.
Excuse
me. I'm 34, and I dread the day that we're relegated to watching films on the cell phone.
Yes, so do I.
Absolutely with you.
But I, Mr. Schrader, do you think the theater going experience will become obsolete?
No, but it will start to mirror more and more the theatrical experience. It will become more of an event.
You think it will be like the preview, basically the movie, the going to the theater is almost going to be like just an incredibly expensive ad for the DVD.
Well, there won't be DVDs.
So that's true. That's going to go too.
Within 4 years, DVDs are gone. You know, you can put them right next to your CDs.
Oh, great. Okay. I'm losing money by the day here.
But we do see that today. We do see that today where people don't want to pluck down $15 for a film unless they're going to be wowed like they're at an amusement park.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And that's been happening over 2 decades now.
Yeah.
And here's another interesting phenomenon. We're now creating a generation of young people who don't think they should pay for entertainment. Why should I pay for music?
Mm-hmm.
Music is in the air. Music is free. Music is file shared. It started with music. Now it's happening with pornography. The web is full of...
Well, didn't the pornography come first, though, the free? That came before the music.
No, no, not free pornography.
Oh, okay.
Pornography is now free. The web is full of watch me and my girlfriend websites.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And so all of a sudden, now, well, we don't need to pay for music. We don't need to pay for porn. Why should we pay for movies?
And you can't stop that. Once that genie's out of the bottle, you're never going to be able to enforce that.
Yeah, and you can make music and you can make porn in your living room. It's awful.
You can do
hard
anything.
Yeah.
I mean,
God knows I do both.
Okay, but this is the whole. This comes from the punk movement, the do-it-yourself movement. The internet is sort of the ultimate realization of this.
So it's awfully hard to make, you know, movies of scale in your living room.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, that's true. That's
even with those little toy soldiers.
Well, if you'll permit us to go back through some of the great films that do grace your resume, we were talking about the film criticism. I want to know, are you able to apply that same kind of critical thinking to your own work from your early days as a critic?
I try not to. It's rough because I am, you know, basically an analytical person.
Yeah.
But, you know, a film critic is in many ways like a medical examiner. You know, he looks at the body and tries to explain how and why it lived and whether its life had any value. A filmmaker is like a pregnant woman. You know, she's just trying to give birth to this thing.
Yeah.
And if you let that medical examiner half of you into the birthing room, he will kill that baby.
Oh, that's that is beautifully stated. Yeah.
So you've
yeah.
got to keep him out because he's not interested in seeing that baby live. He's just interested in dissecting it.
But if you look back at your career, are there films that you can see and you can see that presents a major period of growth for me, or is it a mistake to take out any title and single out any title in particular?
Well, I mean, look, they don't all work, and there are lesser and greater successes and lesser and greater failures, and you know, you try not to, you know, advertise your failures too much because occasionally you run into people who actually think they're good, and at which point you just bite your lip and look
right.
at your shoes and say thank you.
Right.
But, you know, I mean, in my mind, I know which ones work and I know which ones failed, and I sort of know why. And the hardest part is when you're actually in the process of doing it, keeping yourself from overanalyzing it, because you know it's a living, breathing kind of mutating thing. It changes right in front of your eyes, and you have to walk every day. You have to walk on the set or over to the keyboard with an absolutely open mind.
Yeah, and you say that it's such a living thing. Isn't the outcome of a great movie, isn't it kind of not to be defined in a way? I mean, I look at Taxi Driver, and we brought this up Wednesday, a great screenplay, great star, great director, but there was something else that makes this a timeless movie, some kind of indefinable chemistry where you all were living in that place.
Well,
it's
called the zeitgeist. You know,
yeah.
I mean, the three of us happened to meet at the right time in our lives,
mm-hmm.
but we also met in the right time sociologically. And we were, you know, on the cusp and fearless without even knowing how fearless we were because it felt so real, so right. And, you know, occasionally you get lucky that way.
Well, in terms of Taxi Driver, I mean, there's such. It seems like you all were just so hungry to explore that world. I'm wondering how much of a presence were you on that set?
Not much, because I was already beginning to direct my first film.
Sure.
I was there during pre-production, and we rewrote the script a bit during pre-production. And I think I visited the set twice while
okay.
we were shooting.
Only twice, okay.
But I was in Los Angeles working, trying to set up Blue Collar at that time.
Sure.
And also I happen to believe that by the time a director is making a film, if the writer hasn't gotten it right, he never will. And
right.
It no longer belongs to him anymore. And Bobby called me once from the set, and he said, you know, I was thinking, you know, do you think Travis would say this in a scene he was going to do the next day? And I said, Bobby, you know, you're in New York. I'm in L.A. You're wearing my shirt and my boots, which he was.
Yeah.
You're making the film. If you think this character would say that, he probably would.
Yeah.
And that's the way it should be on a film, you know.
Yeah.
If the actor is in the zone and the director is in the zone, they don't need the writer anymore. They're now living the life.
Right.
I completely. If I can ask real quick, I know that you're often asked about a sequel to Taxi Driver, and I think you've pretty much shot it down and said that that's not a possibility. But in a way, do you feel that Bringing Out the Dead is kind of the closest thing we have to a sequel to Taxi Driver?
Well, yeah. I mean, Unfortunately, it was written for a young person, and circumstances prevailed, and an actor was cast who was 10 years too old. So it didn't have the buzz that it should have,
mm-hmm.
which would have given it that Taxi Driver buzz.
Yeah.
You had a kind of a midlife guy having an adolescent crisis.
Yes.
Okay.
But I do feel like a kind of an arc, a full circle between that and Taxi Driver, and kind of a maturity as well. We talked about it on Wednesday's show, whereas Taxi Driver, the only release, the only orgasm, if you will, that this character can enjoy is an act of violence. And bring out the dead, all he wants is peace, and he seems to be coming from that same place as Bickle did. Do you sense that? I mean, did you craft it like that?
Yeah, I mean, you try not to get too on the nose.
Yeah.
You know, I've written these four scripts, which I think in my mind are sort of linked, which is Taxi Driver, American Gigolo, Light Sleeper, and The Walker.
Yeah.
You know, and a guy 20, 30, 40, 50. And he's a taxi driver, he's a gigolo, he's a drug dealer, and he's a society walker.
Right.
Mm.
Now, in most people's minds, there's no real connection with these kind of people. But in my mind, there is. To my mind, that's the evolution of a soul.
Absolutely.
And so that's the kind of artistic glue that makes something cook, because it's not one-to-one. It's sort of one-and-a-half-to-one. And, you know, and whenever there really are connections, if they're one-to-one, they're not very interesting. They always have to be slightly off to make them interesting.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. There's a movie of yours that I keep coming back to time and time again, and I watch it at least once a year, and that film is Hardcore. A dynamic performance from George C. Scott, but that wasn't necessarily the most harmonious of relationships, was it?
Well, yeah. Well, there's a lot of George stories. I could fill up a considerable amount of time with George stories.
Yeah.
I don't want this to, you know, we'll give this another 15 minutes, but I think then we'll start to bring it together.
Okay.
If you want to go into George stories, I'll give you a George story, though.
That I would be delighted to hear a George story.
Whatever you can offer us,
they'd be great.
Okay, so we are, you know, George is an alcoholic, was at the time. And his agent said, you know, in the contract, allot 3 lost days to alcoholism, which we did, and surprisingly enough, that we lost 3 days due to alcoholism. So she obviously knew her business. So we're shooting in San Francisco, and we're in the red light district, and it's a Saturday night, and we have a scene that's quite complicated in one direction, which George is not in. Very simple the other direction, which George is in. And so I said to the AD, "What should we do?" And he said, "Well, go for the meat. Always go for the meat," meaning shoot the most complicated stuff first.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. So we shot that. We dragged George, which was a huge mistake, because that left him in his trailer for three, four hours. So when we turned around the cameras, except for George, I started getting the messages. He won't come. He won't come up. So we sent the second AD, sent the first AD, sent the production manager. The producer happened to be there. We sent the producer. George won't come out. He wants to talk to you. So I go there, and he is sitting in the back of the trailer in his skivvies. And I had another experience with him summerly. When he got drunk, he always tended to take off his clothes. When the first time I met him, he was in a bar, and he was completely nude. He had taken off all his clothes. He was drunk. And so I, as soon as I saw him sitting there in the skivvy, I thought, "Oh fuck, he's smashed." So I went over to him and I tried to explain to him that we needed him on the set, blah blah blah. And he said, "This movie's a piece of shit." You know, and I said, oh, you know, George, you know, when you're making a movie, sometimes you lose faith, you get a little disillusioned, but in the end, I said, oh, she said, shut up, it's a piece of shit. It's a piece of shit, and you're a piece of shit director.
Oh, no.
He said, you're a good writer, but you're a terrible director. And so I sat down with him, and I talked some more, and trying to find a way to... Finally, I said to him, I said, George, we've got two shots to do with you here tonight. I can combine them into one shot. Now, I'll light the shot, and you can walk right from the trailer, and as soon as you walk in, we'll say action, and you just say these two lines and exit, and then you can go in your car and you go home. If you don't do that, we have to come back here next Monday rather than be in San Diego, and you will have to be on this film two more days. And that made some sense to him. So he slapped me on the shoulder and said, okay, good, I'll do it, kid, but only under one condition. I said, well, what's that? He said, you have to promise me that you will never direct another motion picture. And I got on my hands and knees in that trailer and knelt before George and put my hands in the praying position and said, Mr. Scott, I promise you I will never direct another motion. And he slapped me on the shoulder. He said, good, kid, good. All right, let's go.
Oh, that is a classic story.
That is. It's great.
I know you've got like 10 minutes with us. I want to ask about your future. I want to ask about Adam Resurrected and then close with your film canon, because I had a question I was just dying to ask you from that. We have a caller. Let me see if we can take a call real quick with a question for you. 210 area code. Go ahead.
Hey, guys. It's Aaron.
Hey, Aaron.
Hey, Aaron.
Hey, I'm the Mr. Schrader. This is quite an honor. I'm the home entertainment editor of Movie Geeks United, and it's just an honor to talk to you. I was just wondering, just to bring it back earlier, too, on film criticism, I was wondering what you thought on the current state of criticism, and that so many critics, not only, it seems, not only on mid-level papers, but now it seems to have been reported that buyouts of major critics like David Anson at Newsweek are occurring. And I was wondering, what do you think of these?
Well, you're confusing two issues. One issue is... you know, the general decline of film criticism.
Right.
The other larger issue is the absolute collapse of the newspaper business.
Right.
Now, the newspaper business is going down in flames.
Right.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, who knew when the Internet came up that there's a swath of destruction? You know, first came the music business, now the newspaper business, and, you know, who knows, next maybe the movie business.
Mm-hmm.
But it's just wiping out a lot of stuff. But the newspaper business is in the crash and burn mode. So... there's a lot of interesting criticism, but, you know, it's spread all over the place. You know, my friend David Kerr, who writes the DVD reviews for the New York Times,
right.
You know, he's got a very interesting website, you know. A lot of James Rosenblum Baum has a website, Roger Ebert's website. You know, there's a lot of interesting criticism going on. There's only a few places left for the heavyweights to work, you know, the David Denbys and the David Aronsons, the Peter Travers of this world. But, you know, the criticism is mutating to the web, which is, you know, unfortunate because it doesn't pay any money. Mm. I'm friends with Scott Foundas, who's a critic for LA Weekly and Variety.
Right.
And, you know, Scott can't make a living because... there is no economic underpinning for the film criticism business anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, to complete my question, what I was curious is that the Internet has created this new avenue for criticism, and it seems that there is a hunger for discussion of film on the Internet, but it seems that the irony is that now there seems to be no economic incentive before that it seems almost to be truly done out of passion and love for film, for
yeah.
the medium of film.
Yeah,
I mean, and that's, you know, that's a pity, because, you know, a real working film critic has bills like the rest of us.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, yeah. Thank you, Aaron.
Thank you, Aaron.
For your call. We'll see you next week on the show. Just real quick, this is a fun question. Your film canon. That was published in the Film Comment magazine a couple of years ago. Mr. Goldblum, when he was on our show, he talked about the essential films that you gave him to look over, which are films that you return to before you embark on any new work. Rules of the Game, Masculine, Feminine, Tokyo Story. There was a title in the film canon that I am dying to hear your take on, and it's the most recent film on the canon, and that is The Big Lebowski. I'm dying to know Paul Schrader's take on The Big Lebowski.
Yeah, really.
Well, that's a very hard film to make, you know. And you know, comedy is not easy. And,
no, it's not.
And I mean, good comedy. You know, I mean.
No, that's what I mean. It's hard.
Yeah.
I mean,
cock-out
jokes, you know. But I mean, really smart comedy that makes you think while you're laughing.
Mm.
And I think I put in like four comedies in that list. I put in a Keaton, a Chaplin. I put in Lady Eve.
Mm.
Maybe the Marx Brothers, maybe not. But then I thought, who's really? And I think Big Lebowski will absolutely stand the test of time, and it will get better and better known, and better appreciated. And it's already happening. And it's a rare example of a comedy that truly has the chops of greatness.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. And such a comedy of behaviors over a comedy of, you know, punchlines. It's all in the rhythms and the dynamics between those characters. It's amazingly funny. And you're working with Criterion now. Are you working with Criterion on Mishima? How close?
Yeah, well,
I'm
just about finished. It comes out in June now. We've been fooling around with this for almost a year and a half. Doing a new DI for Mishima, adding a scene, doing some sky replacement, and then all the extras and everything. And I'm really glad that we're getting this out. We had to wait 25 years because after 25 years, the rights reverted from Warner Brothers Francis Coppola and George Lucas. And once they got a hold of it, then we were able to sell it to Criterion and have this reissue.
Oh, bless Criterion. They do great work.
Yeah, they do awesome work.
Yes.
I'm going to buy it, even though the DVD is going to become obsolete. I'm going to buy it.
Well, it will look nice on your shelf.
That's right.
That's great. So tell me where you are with Adam Resurrected. We heard from Mr. Goldblum about that film. It sounds like an incredibly challenging, exciting project.
I have a good feeling about that film. It is very, very bold, very unique, and it is a kind of above the fold movie.
Yeah.
You know, there's a phrase in a newspaper business, a story is above the fold or below the fold.
Right.
Mm.
And a film like The Walker is kind of a below the fold movie, but Adam is definitely above the fold. It's kind of a big subject and a very bold undertaking, and you know, Jeff gives, you know, the performance that he has spent his whole life preparing to give.
That's the sense I get, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And but we are done with it now. I haven't seen a final print yet. It's because we just finished a few days ago in Germany. But it creatively, we're done.
But are you thinking that we might see it in the fall, perhaps? Or?
Well, this was a film that was entirely equity financed. A man from Germany and a man from Israel. And we shot it in Romania and in Israel. And so there is no studio involved.
Okay.
So now the calculation is how to take it into market, how to sell it, you know,
right.
Who to sell it to. But, you know, common sense dictates that it is a sort of end-of-the-year kind of serious awards type film. So I would think it would fall into that marketing pattern.
Well, when it comes up to release time, we would be honored to welcome you back to the show to speak about
yes.
it. And Mr. Schrader, we think the world of you, my friend.
Yes,
thank you so much for being on our show.
Oh, thank you for asking.
Thank you very much.
All right, no last question now.
I think we can wait until you come back next time. We're good. Thank you so much.
Yeah, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye now. That is filmmaker Paul Schrader. Wow.
I you know, you know, whenever... you know, we get on edge like this, it turns out really good, but I could have talked to him the whole night.
You know, we could have, because we had
a lot of questions.
Maybe 20 more questions for him. I had an hour plus, and that was being light. But I, you know, he's so wonderful for taking his time out to spend with us. He said 15 minutes, and that's it, 15 minutes.
Okay.
So thank him so much for that.
Yes.
And I'm sorry, I just looked at the switchboard. We had another caller. I don't know if this was a question for Schrader, but maybe we can get some discussion out of it. 774.
Hello.
774, you there?
Yes, hi. That's okay. I appreciate you just had him on, so that's good.
I'm so sorry I missed your call, man.
No, that's okay. Maybe I can ask you this question. Maybe the audience can answer back.
Sure.
Do you think that it's really, in terms of age, I know that traditionally a lot of filmmakers, they usually, you know, they come to their best in filmmaking in their 60s and 70s. In the past, it's been that way. When you have now a lot of young filmmakers, I mean, from the ages of 20 to even earlier than that, 20 to, now, do you think that you bloom later, or do you think you need the wisdom of some of these traditional filmmakers, cinema photographers?
I think that's a great point, my friend. What's your name?
My name is Russ.
Okay. Hi, Russ.
How you doing?
I think that's a very good point. You know, and you have the true artists out there. You have the Paul Thomas Andersons and the filmmakers just coming up that you can tell they have the motivation to make their epic right out of the gate.
Mm.
And you know, There Will Be Blood, which was a big picture last year, feels like that. By the same notion, I can't wait to see who Paul Thomas Anderson is in 50 years. When he gets to Paul Schrader's stage, how much more maturity his films will be filled with. And I think the wisdom of years plays a lot into it.
Informs our last guest, that's for sure. Mm-hmm.
This last film from Paul Schrader that he just alluded to at the end of the interview, this sounds like the most challenging film he has ever made, both in terms of content and the production of the thing. So he hasn't slowed down one bit, and I think that that's inspiring.
To
never let go of that passion, mm-hmm. and to challenge yourself just as much. You can look at his career. You can look at Taxi Driver as that kind of film,
mm-hmm.
As that kind of early film where we're so hungry, we want to get out of the gate, we want to make something that'll be timeless, and they did. But now he's making Adam Resurrected that is every bit as provocative and as daring and as epic as anything he's ever done.
Right.
I don't know exactly how to answer your question.
Right.
I'm sure he would say something similar. But
yeah, I think the wisdom, and it's some directors, look, there's some directors who worked till the very end, John Huston, Alfred Hitchcock, and they never lost that fire in the belly, and they did get better with age. That I think that's true of Eastwood too, to an extent. I think it's true with Schrader's friend Scorsese.
Mm-hmm.
I think he just keeps getting better and better, and it's there. But I do think the wisdom does. I mean, there are some directors, I am curious, I want to know what kind of films Tarantino is going to make in another 10, 20 years, if he's even interested.
Then again, I don't know how much of the interview you listened to, Russ, but did you catch the whole interview, basically?
No, I actually went, for some reason, it went off and on, so I had to kind of come back on.
Okay,
but,
if you listen back in the archives, he talks about how he fears the end is near for the movie-going experience as we know it.
Right.
But, you know, and there's some indications of that where there have been some outstanding directors who, as they got older, weren't given the opportunity. They couldn't get a movie off the ground. I'm thinking about people like Hal Ashby. He made Being There and Coming Home and some extraordinary films in the 70s.
Dog Day Afternoon.
That's Dog Day Afternoon. That's Sidney Lumet. And that's another
Sidney
example
Lumet.
Of some
Look,
of
he's still career. Doing incredible.
That's
yeah,
a classic
yeah.
right there, right?
Absolutely. But the nature of the studio system really tears these guys down. I mean, even Schrader himself, he has to work 4 or 5 years to finance the next film.
Yeah, he's having trouble.
Okay, guys, I want to thank you very much for having me on, okay?
No problem. Thank you
so much.
Okay, we'll come back. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Bye-bye now.
Bye-bye.
It's always great to hear from a listener. Olivia, I see you out there in the chat room. Why don't you call in and tell us about your show tonight before our next guest comes on? I really want to share it with people.
Yeah.
And meanwhile, Jerry, you worked all day yesterday on an independent project.
Yeah, let me go ahead and talk about that. I worked on my friend Francis's film, Francis Abbey's film, Boxing Day. I just helped out in the set, but I was there all day, and they're filming again today. But they're all, I hope they're listening to the show. They said they were going to listen. Or, good friend Paul Bassetti, in charge of 10 Sundays Productions, he was looking forward to this show, and I talked with him the whole day, and we talked all day about Schrader, so
yeah.
In between takes and everything. But no, this is my friend Francis's movie, which I'm plugging on my MySpace page, and it should be good. I hope we can have them all on when it's done on the
That'd
show.
That'd be nice. We will welcome them all.
Yeah, that'll be a fun show, no doubt.
Yeah, I think so. I'm worried now.
What are you worried about?
What
are you worried about?
Because he asked if I had any other questions, and I didn't want to make it sound like I didn't have any other questions, because I did. I just didn't want to take up any more of his time. He was so generous to us. Yes, these little things I worry about.
Yeah, no, I had a whole bunch of, well, we'll talk later, but I had a whole bunch.
I know. There's the little things that nag me. I don't want
what
to think
I
that
like,
I...
What I like, though, when I before Olivia calls in, I would like, what I liked is we were able to take it in a direction we
different
didn't
direction.
Think we would go, and I love
yeah.
that. It was
fantastic.
Very spontaneous, and I love that.
Fantastic conversationalist
yeah.
he is. I think this is Olivia. We
okay.
got a 480 area code. Let me see here. I got to hear about her
don't
big
show. Don't give it out. Don't give it out.
Her big show tonight. Olivia.
Hello, yeah.
Hello, darling. How you doing?
Hi, Olivia.
Good. Great interview, you guys.
Thank you.
Really good. And what
Thank
a good
you.
Guest he was. Wow.
You can't ask for a more
He really is a great storyteller.
Like, yeah.
I know. I'm just thinking, oh, please, God, let... Let's hope see that way tonight.
You know, and it's undeniable. You cannot deny this man's place in movie history. I mean,
oh,
Taxi
no,
Driver,
was...
you could just stop there with Taxi Driver and Raging Bull.
Yeah.
I want to hear about your show tonight. I'm crazy
well,
about your show, and you have a very special
awesome.
Guest, don't you?
I do. Tonight I have Greg Proops, a very, very funny man, and he was rescheduled. He was supposed to be on last night, and then in the 11th hour on Friday, oh, can't come until, you know, so I had to reschedule, so... He's on at 7 p.m. Pacific and 10 p.m. Eastern tonight, live interview.
Oh, okay, great.
Most people will know him from Whose Line Is It Anyway, right?
Yeah, Whose Line Is It Anyway? He
yeah.
was in Star Wars Episode 9, Brother Bear. He did the British version of Whose Line Is It Anyway, too. And he does a thing called the Greg Proops Chat Show in Southern California now, which is very, very funny, so... Yeah, I'm kind of nervous because he, you know, he's one of two people, Alan Levy being the only other one that I haven't pre-interviewed, kind of talked to a few. So it's going
right.
to be a blind thing, and I'm a little bit nervous about it, but we'll see.
Well, you know, Olivia, we were, I'm not lying, we were shaking before the show tonight.
I don't have any nails left, Olivia.
Yeah,
I have any nails left, so.
I have soiled this pair of pants.
I didn't need to go that far. Oh, my God.
You guys, you sounded great, Jamie. You didn't, you know, because I know when you were on my show the other night, you were you were worrying about gushing too much and everything. You sounded so cool. So.
I was calling Olivia for therapy, basically. The other time. I said, I don't know what I'm going to do.
Okay.
It came out really wonderfully, and I could tell he was the kind that really puts you right at ease.
He
yeah,
did. That's what I didn't expect.
So, Olivia, your show tonight, 7 p.m. Pacific, 10 p.m. Eastern, Greg Proops.
Greg Proops. They call him Proop Dog.
I will be listening, and I'm sure Jerry
will be
too.
Sounds like a good one.
We'll
Thank
be there.
So much,
we'll be there.
Thank you so
and
much, Olivia.
And don't forget to mention our show coming up on the 11th.
Oh, well, let's do it right now. I'm going to be on your show April 11th to talk summer movies.
And what
yeah.
time will that be, Jamie?
I have no idea.
The 11th, I can't remember if you have if the 11th is a Friday.
Is it 9 p.m. my time, April 11th, 9 p.m. Eastern?
Well, I'll tell you what. If it's a Thursday or Saturday, it's at
It's
9.
A Friday. It's a
okay,
Friday, April 11th.
Oh, no, then it's 10 p.m. your time.
Oh, cool.
Okay.
All right.
Great. So we're all set for 10 p.m. We're going to talk movies.
That's right. That's
yeah.
right. I look forward to it, darling.
Well,
thank you so much.
It was a great show. Really enjoyed it. Thanks, guys.
Thank you, sweetie. Bye-bye now.
Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Olivia Wilde, a great, entertaining show. You talk about a loose, free-for-all show where everybody just comes to party. It's
well,
a great time.
That sounds like a good show. While we're plugging things, let's just plug our Good Friends Horror Movie Fans. Have a show, a special time, 10:30 tonight. They have Heather Amos and Greg Lamberson on at 10:30.
Yeah.
And Will is going to be on. Will from HorrorYearbook.com supposedly is going to be on. So,
there you go. I'm interested to know who their dream guest is.
Well let's find out.
Yeah.
Well, I'm waiting. Okay. All right. Well, they're in the chat room, so I'm just waiting to... Oh, yeah. Think of the
guy.
Active
chat room tonight.
Yeah, it is a very active chat room. Yeah. Slime City, yeah, these are the Slime City people. And Will is going to... Will loves this film, doesn't he? Bruce Campbell.
He's everyone's Bruce Campbell.
Guess.
I've tried several times to get Bruce Campbell on the show. He is like the lost Ark of the Covenant. He is like this.
Yeah, he is.
This bright shining thing that you just, you know.
Dave, you interviewed Bruce Campbell on Wednesday? Oh my God.
Yeah. Well, tell you what, this is a popular guy.
Yeah, he's all over the place.
He's a cult hero.
That's awesome.
On
himself. Awesome catch, Dave. That's great.
Yeah, congratulations, guys. And actually, during our one-year anniversary show, we will divulge our how we put together the show like we do every week. And there's some interesting tidbits about people that have called us and contacted us, and people that we just missed having on the show.
Right.
Regrets I've had a few. I mean, for instance, I don't know if we've ever revealed this on the show. Maybe I haven't revealed it on the show before. Our Pacino tribute.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We very nearly had Frank Serpico on the show.
Mm-hmm.
But it was too booked. He got to us too late. And that was a big regret. Actually, this weekend we almost had Martin Landau on the show, but he's in a plane overhead while the show's going on right now, so he wasn't necessarily able to be with us. But I will tell you all those great stories during the one-year anniversary.
Yes, we will.
If everyone can join us for that. We're a couple of minutes away from welcoming Ira Sachs, the director of Married Life, which, Jerry, you checked out the other night.
It's a very good film. I really liked it. It's not what I expected, which is... You know, which is not a good or a bad thing. I just didn't expect it. But it was a lot funnier than I thought it would be, and like more like black comedy. But I have to say, I really recommend the film. It's a very nice period piece, and that shouldn't turn you off. It's got a great cast, Pierce Brosnan, Chris Cooper, Rachel McAdams, and Patricia Clarkson. And it's just a really neat movie with a lot of unexpected twists, and I really strongly recommend it. And I'm sure Ira Sachs is going to tell us how he came up with this, because I'm very curious to know. This just came out of nowhere.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm thinking about the whole argument that the movie going is could be dead in my mind, and it reminded me that just a few hours ago I dropped off my brother and his son at the theater to see Shudder.
Well,
and,
that will do it. That will do it.
That's not an argument against the end of cinema.
No, I mean, I didn't see it. I haven't seen I'd rather just see the original film that it's based on than see this one, but I'm just really have no interest in Shudder right now. I'm sorry. I just don't.
Right, and I was trying to recommend other movies, but then I was looking at everything else in the multiplex right now.
Well, what about
difficult.
The Bank Job? I would have recommended the Bank Job.
The Bank Job, absolutely. And wasn't it a joy to hear what Mr. Schrader just saw? He saw three movies in the theater yesterday.
Yeah, he's like me. He's like me some days. I mean, that's great.
And those are questions that rarely get asked. You know, the everyday questions. What's the last movie you saw in a movie theater? Where do you like to sit in a movie theater?
Right.
I want to ask Mr. Scorsese, if we ever have the opportunity to have him on, where do you like to sit in the auditorium?
These are all. But that was great. That just slipped out. And to see that, to hear him say what he does, and he actually goes to the movies, check out what's out there, you don't hear that often, so it's very nice.
Yeah. Now, I am a week away from attending the Sarasota Film Festival, where I will be taking in about 30 movies, which could amount up to 4 or 5 movies a day.
Wow.
So I will come back with a scoop on all these movies. And I'll be meeting some interesting people. Keith Ulick, who's been a guest several times, is going to meet me up there, I believe.
Oh, that should
be fun. Finally be able to get in touch with him. It's being attended this year by people like William H. Macy and Steve Buscemi and Charlize Theron. And if you heard the interview with the festival programmer a couple of weeks back, you'll know all the details of it. So some great movies, so I'm about to embark on that. Then we'll be back next Sunday, and let me pull this up so I can get our guest list here. We're going to be welcoming the screenwriter of a new family film called Nim's Island.
Oh, that's right. That comes out Friday.
Jodie Foster, Abigail Breslin. Really kind of different change of pace for Jodie Foster doing a film like this.
Yeah, this would be interesting. Isn't Gerard Butler in that?
He is.
Okay.
Screenwriter's name is Paula Mazur. We're going to be bringing her on, as well as a great comic actor who I know that everybody's crazy about. His name is Judah Friedlander.
Oh, that's great.
You might know him from, he's in the new movie Chapter 27, but he's also a major role in the great sitcom 30 Rock.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, so. Yeah, yeah. He's a great presence on screen, very funny guy, so we're going to welcome him on, too. Then, like I said, we'll be off for the next two Wednesdays leading up to the anniversary show.
Mm-hmm.
So we're waiting for our next caller to call in. What do you want to talk about? How do you want to fill the time here?
I will still talk about Schrader, if that's all right.
Let's do it.
I really found that to be very enjoyable, and it was what William Forsythe and Dana Delany said. He's a great storyteller, and he was very inviting, and that I liked. I didn't feel as soon as he said hello, it was like boom, the ice was broken.
Yeah.
And but there was stuff I wanted to talk about. There are a couple of questions, but we didn't get to it, and so I hope the next time. I'm sorry, but
you understand like the reasoning, right?
Oh, I mean, absolutely. Dude, you handled it fine. No, I understand completely.
Yeah.
I'm not at all not at all dissing you at all. I'm just.
He was so generous to us, and you know, I just thank him so much for the time he spent with us tonight. But there are movies that we didn't get to cover, and the questions, you know, you had a question specifically about his work on Last Temptation, didn't you?
Yeah, I just wanted to know, because I haven't heard yet, really, I don't know if he or Martin Scorsese or William Dafoe ever commented on The Passion of the Christ, because they had all this controversy when The Last Temptation of Christ came out, and then you have this you sort of revisit it with Mel Gibson's The Passion of the Christ. I was just curious if he had seen it and what he thought of it.
Yeah.
And what his impression was.
And plus the fact that, I found The Passion of the Christ every bit as controversial as Last Temptation.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
And yet it translated into major success for Passion.
Yes, it did.
Major infamy for Last Temptation. And plus, does he sense that the tides will turn on Last Temptation, that the public perception of that film will, or maybe it already has, I'm not sure.
I think it has, but I think with the Mel Gibson film, it's more, that's the one that's going to always be remembered more for the controversy at the time. But I know a lot of people who do.
I don't know. I think $400 million is going to erase controversy in a
Well, it's a film that is, I still see people talk about it, but it is the controversy is still the first thing you think of a movie, and then the movie itself. But it is a controversy. I do remember the time. It was just like from.
It was a lot of pre-release controversy.
Yeah, it was insane.
But all of that seemed to be a moot point when people actually went to the box office. All of it seemed to be a moot point from the beginning.
Yeah, because you knew
all of
people
it seemed
were going
to
go
kind
see
of
it.
Manufactured. It didn't interest people, the controversy around that one.
Yeah, it was manufactured. It was on both sides of the thing. It was getting ridiculous. But this started when, I guess, when do you want to say it starts? You want to say it starts August of 2002 when Mel blessed the Vatican in a press conference? You could say it starts there. If it starts with the New York Times magazine profile on Gibson and his father in the winter or the spring of 2003. And it just heats up from there, and the conservative websites are going nuts, and the liberal. It was just insane. I just wanted to see the movie. I just wanted to get it out of my system and see it.
yeah. And the whole Diane Sawyer exchange, about the father, the controversy over his father, and that whole thing.
Yeah.
It all seemed kind of let's throw everything and see what sticks. against this movie, and it dredged up a lot of publicity for the movie. But even without that, there was a movement to go see this film as a spiritual experience.
Yeah, that was, there was no denying. I don't know why people thought this movie wouldn't do well. His name is on it. People, it is, you know, it's the most important story ever told, and you knew it was going to do well. That shouldn't surprise anyone.
In terms of content, maybe I'll get in trouble here. In terms of content, I just found so much more of Christ's lessons in Last Temptation.
So did I.
Over Passion.
Mm-hmm.
Especially in connection to the other films that Mel Gibson has directed. Look at Apocalypto. Look at Braveheart.
Right.
This man has a bloodlust. It infects every movie he directs. He's consumed by making it as gory and brutal as possible. That's what he gets off on.
Well, yeah.
And of course you want to pay respect to that in terms of Christ's ultimate sacrifice for us. But it seems like ad nauseum. You know, it seemed like that was its only reason for being, was to push that envelope.
Right. Well,
and it was missing a lot of those lessons that are so valuable.
Right. It's you know, I wonder, because I think if he was 20 years younger, he would have played Christ in his own, and he would have, you know, in his own movie. I think he would have played him.
Yeah.
I don't doubt that.
And it almost seemed like, and I think it was, it almost seemed like an afterthought to put in those vignettes that kind of cut between the crucifixion. You know,
mm-hmm.
where he's with his mother and you know,
where he's building the table.
Almost an afterthought. I think it was. I think Gibson found that it needed some levity somewhere. It needed something to take you out, if only for a few moments of that violent, brutal atmosphere.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Now, that's an interesting conversation to have. We just opened up a can of worms that we could fill a show with, and
we could. We've had a couple. No, it's been a good show so far. So.
But it absolutely, talk about the representative of Mr. Schrader's challenging and provocative work, his screenplay for Last Temptation of Christ. It's just in there with the remainder of his resume, and we thank him so much for his time tonight.
Yeah.
And we're ready to start our whole new guest segment, and we're
right.
excited about this one too. In a modern cineplex overrun by torture killings and CGI woolly mammoths, what a pleasure it is to come upon an intelligent movie about human relationships. Critically acclaimed writer-director Ira Sachs' latest is such a film. Married Life features the most appealing cast of the year. It stars Pierce Brosnan, Chris Cooper, Patricia Clarkson, and Rachel McAdams as they headline this fantastic film that takes so many of the conventions from the 1940s relationship dramas and turns them on their head. It is a picture filled with incredibly nuanced performances, sharp and insightful writing, and characters that actually surprise you. This is just the latest achievement for this terrific filmmaker, whose previous drama, 40 Shades of Blue, took home the Sundance Grand Jury Prize in 2005. It is a great pleasure to welcome writer-director Iris Sachs to our program. Let's see if I can bring him up here. Mr. Sachs, are you with us?
I'm with you.
Thank you so much for being with us.
Did my mother pay you for that introduction?
well, thank you. Thank you for that.
Thank you for being on the show.
I haven't received that check yet, but I'm interested watching Married Life, a fantastic movie. I'm interested in what movies initially inspired you and made you want to become a filmmaker.
In 1986, I spent 3 months living in Paris, and I was a lonely college student who didn't speak French and didn't know anyone very much. And I ended up spending most of that time in the movie theaters. I saw about 200 films in 3 months. Discovered Cassavetes for the first time, discovered Vincent Minnelli for the first time, discovered Maurice Pialat for the first time. A lot of movies, John Ford, never heard of him. You know, I discovered cinema, really. And I think that's what first made me want to work in film.
Was there anything about pictures like Douglas Sirk at all that
I got to Sirk through Fassbender, actually, backwards.
That's great. Ali Theories of the Soul?
Ali, one of my favorite films.
Yeah, okay.
Veronica. I mean, I think Fassbender in general has been... I love Cirque's work, but I think Fassbender just speaks to me maybe more directly in a certain way.
I see that. I can see that.
There's an interest in class. There's an interest in certain kind of internal conflicts that's consistent in his work that obviously Cirque involved in those things as well. But both those filmmakers were very influential. I think Cirque less for this film than for 40 Shades of Blue. I think because the film is set in 49, people think of Cirque, but for me, I really think of Joan Crawford and Betty Davis and why, you know, kind of more films of the 40s, Preminger, early Hitchcock, that kind of stuff than Cirque particularly.
Yeah.
Cirque is more the 50s, right?
Yeah, and for me, it's just this is not a film about repression, and I think that's...
Not at all.
You know, this is a film about the difficulties of being intimate, which I relate to, but it's not specifically about repression. And I think Cirque and the 50s in general are so known for that, as a mythology perhaps, but that's what we think of. And so this film I set in 49, very specifically, before the beginning of what, you know, the Eisenhower years.
Right.
And all that stuff.
Yeah. Was this adapted from a book?
It was yes, it was. It was in 2001. I spent a summer reading Pulp Fiction, and I found this book called Five Roundabouts to Heaven, which was by a man named John Bingham, a British mystery writer who was also a member of the MI5. He was part of the British Secret Service, and he was actually John le Carré's mentor in the Secret Service. And the character of Smiley is based on John Bingham, the writer of this book. And I think in a certain way you see the relationship in Chris Cooper's character.
Oh, totally, yeah.
Between the spy and the husband.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
So what about the material made you want to dedicate your time to it and explore further?
Well, I had been watching a lot of these 40s movies and been struck by sort of their entertainment pleasure, their kind of over-the-top storylines, but also I found them... You know, I think Joan Crawford is a really great actress. I think people, she has such a biography that we're aware of that people forget how effective those performances can be in a way that's so different than how people work today. And I think, for me, what I loved about this book is that it was a thrill to read. It's a page-turner in a certain way, but also it very easily and fluidly, I think, speaks to things about human relationships and long-term romance that I found were very personal and real. The turning point for me is when you discover a little secret about the Pat Allen character played by Patricia Clarkson.
Suddenly
her character becomes more complicated than you expect. The whole movie did, and the whole book did, and I think that's what it becomes almost a more humanist drama than a sort of straight noir.
I like the way you have you really throughout the film you keep turning this on its head. There are a lot of surprises, a lot of unexpected turns, and it really makes for a great movie.
Well, I'm glad to hear you experience it that way. One of the pleasures is actually watching it with an audience in a movie theater, which I've done a few times, and you sort of sense that there's a collective experience that happens, and I think that's something that's kind of one of the things we get from going to the movies is we're not watching it only at our homes and on our televisions. There's actually something that happens as a group, and I think this movie, it's like what I could consider a popcorn film on some level.
Right.
The audience is talking to the screen.
Well, that's just it. I mean, they probably go in with certain expectations because we've seen films that deal with these elements before, you know, infidelity and what have you, and we expect it to follow a certain pattern, and your film, to its credit, does not necessarily follow all those patterns.
Right.
And what a godsend, like I said in the intro, to actually have a film out there about people and the intricacies of human relationships. And was that a hard project to get off the ground, a movie that's actually about people?
Well, I think luckily, you know, Hollywood is filled with people who want to make a lot of money. It's also filled with a lot of people who are over the age of 40. So I think on some level this is a film for adults and about adults, and I think that once there was enough response to the story, it's a good read, and then really to this set of actors, I think. On some level I feel like I pulled one over on them, which is not what I meant to do, meaning it's just but it's sort of what happened naturally, because I think it's a film with a lot of suspense made by someone who's not a suspense director, and I think that's what kind of makes it its own can of worms, to tell you the truth. Mm. I think it's the most interesting part of the film, but I think for some who want something that's kind of pre-digested, that's not what this film is.
Right.
Right. And so just to give us our audience a sense, of, if you can tell us a basic plot synopsis of the story and the characters we're dealing with.
The film is called Married Life. It's the story of, it's set in 1949 in a kind of mythic American town, and it's the story of a very gentle, middle-aged married man who falls in love with another woman, a younger woman, and decides that to divorce his wife will cause her too much pain, so better to kill her. And it then really becomes a suspense film about the nature of intimacy and between these four characters. Chris Cooper plays the husband. Patricia Clarkson plays the wife. Rachel McAdams plays the young ingenue between the two of them. And then Pierce Brosnan is the kind of bachelor best friend who ends up falling for the girl. And you know, hilarity ensues.
You could not ask for a better cast. And I want to ask about these actors. And just a little bit, but I see that it was this a collaboration with a co-writer, the screenplay?
Yeah, I wrote the film with a wonderful writer named Oren Moverman, who I had first met. He's actually a good friend of mine before we started working together, but the reason I sort of sought him out to meet Oren was that I admired his work on Jesus' Son.
I love that film.
And as his adaptation of Dennis Cooper's work. He was a co-writer on that. And Oren also worked with Todd Haynes. He was the co-writer, I'm Not There.
Mm-hmm.
And he's actually about to direct his first movie, so that's very exciting.
Wow.
For us as well.
Yeah, I see his name attached to so many outstanding credits past and future. I've always been interested in him.
Yeah, well, you should get him on your show. I mean, he knows more than most of us about movies. And he's from Israel. He moved here, went to Brooklyn College in film, went out to find Andre Gregory and started working on work with him for a while. It's just like a passionate lover of movies, and that comes through, I think, in the writing.
Oh, we definitely need him.
We love that. We love that.
Yeah.
So was there a rehearsal? Were you allowed a rehearsal period at all?
You know, I don't, by preference, I don't like to rehearse my actors in advance, at least a typical sort of, you know, the conventional rehearsal, in the sense that I don't want an actor to hear or to really play out very much what they want to do with their material before we start shooting. What I do is I sit down with them and talk through the script in terms of any questions and things that we can do. And then what I did on this film, which I'd never done before, but it worked, is I sort of set up rehearsals without the director, meaning Chris Cooper and Pierce Brosnan spend an evening, you know, having a good meal and drinking a little bit and talking and sharing their lives because they play best friends. And it turned out to be enough. I mean, I'm sure it's, you know, it wasn't a deep friendship which was created in that moment, but there was some level of familiarity.
It established a comfort. Yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And, you know, for me, it was actually, I heard an interview once with Sidney Pollack, and he said that he never rehearsed his actors. And I found that, like, really liberating, because I think rehearsal tends to make things more specific and more kind of preordained in terms of what someone's trying to get across. And I don't want to know what they're trying to get across, and I don't really want them to know on a conscious level. And I think that comes through in these performances. There's something, there's a surprise within the moment, within each instance of the performances on screen.
Yeah, I know that. Seeing documentaries on how Coppola works, and I know that Coppola, I know he likes to rehearse, but more than anything, he likes to get his cast together just to spend regular time together. It's to create kind of a familial environment, which, when you're talking about something like a Godfather, I mean, that's essential.
Yeah. I mean,
but
I think what I did have is there was a common element that these four actors were very ambitious with their emotions in this film and very honest with their emotions, and I think that comes through.
It does.
In the film, and I think the couple, the married couple that Chris Cooper and Patricia Clarkson create, I realized a few weeks ago that I actually suddenly thought that they actually existed somewhere. There's a real intimacy that was.
Yeah,
that's
true.
Yeah, I mean, Chris Cooper, I mean, you talk about last year's best performance, in my opinion, in Breach, and again this year with your film. I want to ask about all these actors, but Chris Cooper in particular, what makes him unique? What is it about him that draws us to him?
Well, I think there's something, he's a real everyman in a certain way.
Mm-hmm.
There's a
familiarity
about
him,
there's something, but as an actor, he actually has a level of genius in the sense that he's able to convey very complex, very honest emotions with such precision and with such, you know, working with him, I felt a little like I was working with an idiot savant, which is not to say he's an idiot, but there's a level of the opposite, you know, but I think that there's a level of passion about Carrion Cross, what he's trying to convey emotionally about every half a second, beat of the movie that's so intense. So he's able to make, because he seems like an everyman, you feel like he's just like you, and yet what he's able to convey as an artist is really so grand.
Yeah, yeah. And I would think that working with all these terrific actors, actors are all different. They all have different kind of demands and how they like to be approached and directed.
Mm-hmm.
Did you find that the case with these four, where some would want less talk, less direction, some would want more?
Well, I think, you know, being a director, a film director, is not dissimilar to being a therapist or an analyst in a certain way.
Sure.
A lot of what you're doing is listening and trying to reflect back what people are sort of giving across in their material. And I think that a lot of what I did with these actors is listen and try to tell them what I thought was coming across the screen. Actors do know different things. You know, Pierce is someone in 1, 2, 3 takes, that's where he's hot. Rachel, she works towards something that's like more in the 7, 8. You have to figure out, it's a science on some level, but it's not very scientific. And basically you what I was blessed by is that these actors really, really adored each other. There was a lot of respect and ease among them that made it that we were all out to do our best.
Yeah, and tell me about the recreation of the period and his amazing look to the film too. Tell me about the challenge of putting that together.
Well, once we decided that the film, because in a lot of ways this movie could be set present day, the issues are very present day. It's about how hard it is to break up with somebody on some level, and how maybe you shouldn't at the end of the day. I mean, I think
right.
they're very modern issues. About relationships. But once we decided it was a 49 film, and I hired Michael Dennison and Hugo Luczyk-Witowski to be my designers, one with costumes, one with production design, I sort of stopped talking to the actors about 49. I didn't really want them to think about it, because in a way, once we built a world, which is always, when you make a film, somewhat artificial, once that world existed, the actors just had to live it. And live in it. And they didn't really need to, you know, if you give someone the right costume, like Rachel, I think, for example, in this film, a lot of what she was able to do is by thinking about the posture of a woman of her age in that time, and understanding how a woman moved through her clothes and certain kinds of things like that. I think she then became part of that time in a lot of ways. She fit into that world, for example.
Right.
So I think we tried not to talk very much about 1949, to tell you the truth.
One of the things that stood out, and I know this might sound trivial, but the amount that people smoked in the film.
Yeah.
I know that's an odd thing to bring up, but it's just so you don't see it that much in today's movies that take place today, because I just thought, I always find that a very interesting thing to notice.
Well, conveniently, at the time, there were 4 actors who were smokers and 1 director who was a smoker. So we all enjoyed smoking.
Right.
But at this point, I won't say who, but 3 of them have quit. So
okay.
That's the positive news.
No, but the attention to detail, I was really amazed at. I thought they did a great job.
Thank you.
Recapturing that world. And I guess also what it was nice, and as I've gotten older, the period films really appeal to me. But we're so obsessed with technology today, it was so nice not to see any of that.
Well, that was one of the reasons we decided to keep the film in that period, is because this is a suspense film, and a lot of the metaphor of suspense films, as well as the craft of them, are about communication.
Right.
What information do people have, and what don't they have? And I think there was, you know, this is pre-cell phones, pre-computers, pre-answering machines, pre-a lot of things that make there a really essential nature to the problems that these characters are having. And it makes it, I think, almost more like a fable in some
right,
ways.
Yeah.
There's something very sort of very simple, without hopefully being simplistic, about the problems that are going on in these films and how to resolve them.
Yeah. As a filmmaker, what kind of themes are you drawn by? Do you see a common thread amongst certain particular characters or themes?
Well, I think having finished Married Life, it's my third feature, 40 Shades of Blue. Was the film I did before that, and The Delta I made in 1994. Each film is driven by the nature of the complexities of living in an intimate relationship and a lot of deceit. Deceit is really central to all 3 of these films, secrets and lies. And I actually feel like it's out of my system. I feel like I've made a sort of unconscious trilogy of sort of what people hide from other people
right.
in their lives. And I think that, for me, has a lot to do with having grown up gay and learning a lot about intimacy and romantic life in the closet and,
right.
And in sort of in darkness. And I think, I don't know, I feel I'm interested both personally and professionally from sort of moving on from that. My new film is not about lies. It's about other difficulties of intimate life, but it's different than this.
Isn't it amazing how that's just an endless well that you can draw from, the intricacies of the of human relationships and intimacy, like you said. But tell me about do you have any details you can share about your next project?
Yeah, I'm working on a film I'm very excited about it. I've just finished a script. Oren Moverman and I again are writing together. It's called The Goodbye People. It's an adaptation of two books by Gavin Lambert, who was a screenwriter, also a director. He wrote Inside
Baby
Clover. He also wrote the biography of Natalie Wood and the biography of Lindsay Anderson. And Gavin was a British screenwriter who lived in Los Angeles in the 50s, 60s, actually until about 4 years ago when he died. And we've adapted two of his books. The story is set in the end of the 1960s in Los Angeles. It begins on the night of a kind of Sharon Tate, Manson-like murder. And
ooh.
It then sort of goes back in time and focuses on these three characters, an out-of-work gay British screenwriter, an ex-model who's living up in the Hollywood Hills trying to figure out whether she wants to live or die, and this Dreft Dodger who's sort of between the two of them, this beautiful young man who creates a triangle with these three characters and leads them. Really, it's a film about whether or not you're going to stay whether or not, how easy it is to fall off the rails. And I think that was so much an issue in 1969, and for me it's so much an issue right now, is how the difficult disease of staying close to other people means there's always these options, whether it be sex or drugs or cults or anything that we are drawn to in order to make our pain less, more bearable, I guess.
Absolutely. Yeah, man, I'm there for that one right
now.
Yeah,
Gavin
I'm ready.
Lambert, definitely.
Gavin Lambert. Thumbs up.
So what stage are you at with that one?
We're finishing the script now and trying to move forward and hopefully work with a couple of these actors that I've worked with before and create it. It's a real ensemble piece. There's kind of a Nick Ray character. Gavin was actually lovers of Nick Ray at a certain point.
Oh. Mm-hmm.
And they work together on this Joan Crawford film, and there's a kind of Crawford figure. There's a lot of wonderful kind of fabric of Hollywood without being a Hollywood movie, to tell you the truth. It's really
okay.
Yeah.
It's very
man,
personal.
We can't wait for that
God,
one.
God, I'm looking forward to this one.
In terms of married life, I'm sorry?
How was my pitch?
That's very good.
Great
that's
pitch.
Very good.
You sold me.
Okay, good.
If only we had money we could give you to finance the film.
Beginning, I'm practicing.
Now, Married Life, I know it's in limited release right now. When does it open wider?
Well, it just went out pretty wide. It's in about 20 cinemas here in the New York area. It's in most of the major cities. It's in 150 theaters today, so
okay.
It's out there. And and thank you so much for having me on the show.
Thank you for being on.
It is a big pleasure to have
you
on. We were crazy about
your
movie.
I like the title because I think that there's not, you know, one of the things I feel in reading film criticism and various things is that there's a lack of knowledge of, there's a lack of geekness around the history of film in a way. The fact that, like, whatever we're doing, it's probably, we're not reinventing the wheel. There's been a long history that we're all part of.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, we appreciate that. You know, there's so many, we always say this, there's a ton of fan shows out there and gossip-driven shows, but we really wanted to start something that was passionate about the art form and the artist, and that's where our geekdom
right.
is centered.
Well,
so and you're definitely you've made an outstanding film, and you're welcome back anytime. You have a place here on Movie Geeks United anytime you'd like.
Thanks.
Yes, anytime.
Appreciate that.
Thank you very much,
okay.
sir.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye now.
Bye-bye.
That is Ira Sachs, the writer-director of the new film Married Life. Pierce Brosnan, Chris Cooper, and we got a compliment. Wow, that's
I know, that's great.
I never know how to accept those.
And you do a lot of hard work. You should take it very well. just take it, just eat it up. Now the one thing I'd like to add about this movie is that Pierce Brosnan just continues this streak of really like escaping the Bond stereotype, and he sort of plays on it. But like with this and The Matador and Tailor of Panama, he's really come into his own as a really good actor.
Yes, he really has. You know, and he's always been an effortless kind of actor. I think that his work in recent years has really allowed him the opportunity to explore his range.
Yeah.
Even when he's seemingly playing, you know, you remember Bond, and then he went and he did something like Tailor of Panama, which is, you know, Bond flipped on his head.
Anti-Bond almost.
Yeah, yeah, it really is.
And it was a really good film. And he had made some, you know, good films before Bond, even, like, he was very good in The Long Good Friday, and I liked him in The Fourth Protocol, and I know that was a movie that's based on, that's a spy novel by Frederick Forsyth that's based on, and that was the film he did because he wanted to be Bond, and he couldn't get out of the Remington Steele contract. So it went to Timothy Dalton, so he did some other movies. But I like him, and I think the work he's done after Bond has been really strong.
I don't know anyone that's not crazy about him. I mean, women, you know you're a movie star when women want you and men want to be you.
Yeah,
you know?
Exactly.
That kind of is the epitome of the Bond character. That's
right.
What Bond should be. But he's just a dynamic actor. You cannot take your eyes off of him.
Mm-hmm.
And I will stand by his version of the Thomas Crown Affair. I think it's one of the most entertaining movies I've seen in the past decade.
I actually the original, when I saw it, it always felt dated. So I thought the remake was fine. And Rene Russo is really good in that, too.
I thought the remake was amazing.
Yeah.
It's always been one of those movies that I can't get enough of. And Rene Russo is talking about a strong female character, and she just blew it out of the water.
Yeah. She doesn't. They need to give her more parts. She's really good.
Yeah, I think that's been the best part that she's ever been given. And there's all this talk about a Thomas Crown sequel that they're wanting to do.
Yeah, I hope they do it. I hope.
Yeah, me too. We need Pierce on the show so we can ask him about it.
Yeah.
We thank everyone for joining us tonight on the chat room. We have another guest segment coming up, a movie I'm very anxious to explore with this filmmaker. But thanks for joining us out there. This is Movie Geeks United, if you're just now joining us. If you missed the Schrader interview, we interviewed Paul Schrader at the top of the show. You can always tune into the archive. It was a great 40-minute-plus conversation with one of the legends in film, and you're not going to want to miss that. He had a lot of great, insightful things to say about his own work and about the state of movies in general.
And that was to hear it from him was fascinating, to hear his take. And also that he was very eager to go that route. He knew that, you know, if this is where it's going, you better jump on now.
Yeah, and it was kind of funny because I had my list of questions, and he makes a statement out of the blue that movies are dead.
Yeah. Yeah, you can't. Ignore that, and that's what it's sort of like the point of his, you know, some of these things, like the whole thing that was published in Film Comment, the whole canon article, he is saying that. He's even saying that back when that was written. He really does believe that.
Yeah, and all indications point to that direction. I mean, it's a trend.
It's sad.
But you can look at it as a sad thing, but you can also look at it, you know, we're entering a world of new possibilities.
No, that's right. He's right to look at it that way. I think what's sad is what we're seeing, and it was evident with the writer's strike, is that the studios are in a total state of denial about this. They don't understand it like the recording industry was. They just don't get it. They really are, you know, they don't get it. But people like Schrader and other directors of his generation do understand that you've got to jump on the bandwagon and take advantage of the new technology because you can't beat it. It's here to stay.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. It's a very complicated kind of place where we are now.
Yeah, it is.
And you know, and he related to where studios were at the time of the late 60s when his ilk started to come into fruition. You know, but it's a different beast now because we, like he said, we don't know what movies are.
Mm-hmm.
We don't know their identity. Whereas back then they were just behind the loop in terms of content. They weren't appealing to the young people that were hungry and starved for something relating to them.
Right.
And then therein came the Easy Riders and the
which he did not like Easy Rider. He did not.
Yeah, yeah. Well, we didn't get to grill him. We didn't get to grill him on everything, but
no. But that's one of those things. He was fired from when he wrote that. But it's just he's a fascinating figure in American film. Just fascinating.
Yeah, yeah. So who's the big guest now? Who we've talked to in the past year? I mean, we've spoken to more. More legends than we could have ever dreamt.
I never thought a year ago we would have just talked to Paul Schrader. We would have just talked to Brian De Palma, John Badham, Howard Shore, Mark Isham,
yeah,
William Forsythe, yeah, Stephen Bauer,
Philip Baker Hall.
I mean,
who's on the agenda? Maybe we should save it for the 1 year anniversary where we just go off on what we're going to work on for the upcoming year. I mean, I can reveal what our next tribute show will be. Maybe that'll give you a sense of where we're at.
Okay,
Jerry,
reveal it.
I don't even think I've told you yet.
No, you haven't. That's why I'm asking you to reveal it.
We've been so concerned with our past tribute shows. We've dealt with Pacino and Schrader and De Palma and Stanley Kubrick and his last film, Eyes Wide Shut, which was a unique one and one of my favorites. We failed to mention a lot. Our favorite character actors, Alan J. Pakula. We're going to go a little bit different with our next tribute show, where we're going to celebrate the legacy that is the Indiana Jones series.
Oh, hell yeah. When are we... All right, so when do you... All right, just don't do it the Wednesday night before, because I'm going to the midnight show, hopefully.
No. We're going to give you plenty of time to prepare for it prior to the new film that we're all so looking forward to. But that's the direction we're taking the next tribute in. So anyone that wants to chime in on the chat room, give us a kind of test of what you guys think of that idea.
I think it's a great idea.
It should be a lot of fun.
I'll wear my fedora.
That's right. And nothing else. And our next guest is on the line.
That's it.
And we're very excited about bringing him on. Harrison Montgomery is a new film from writer-director Daniel Davila, featuring Martin Landau, Melora Walters, and a true gem of a performance from relative newcomer Octavio Gomez. This big-hearted and magical film captivates the viewer from the first frame. You know you're in the hands of expert performers and a confident director, and you feel like this is a movie that you haven't quite seen before, which is very magical, especially nowadays. It recently enjoyed its premiere just days ago at the Method Fest Festival, and we're pleased to have the man behind the film with us today, Mr. Daniel Davila. Let me bring him on. Daniel, are you with us?
I am indeed.
Daniel, did I get your last name right?
It's pretty close. It's Davila.
Davila. I came close, man.
Yeah, that was actually exceptional. Most people don't get that close.
Welcome to the show.
Well, welcome to
Thanks.
The show very much. We're honored to have you on here. You have a great film in Harrison Montgomery, but I want to talk to you about it, definitely. But first, tell me when you started to become interested in filmmaking.
That's a great question, and it really... Because I don't remember a time when I wasn't fascinated by film, and it started as an avocation. And like so many of us, I'm sure you guys included, you just start watching as many as you can, trying to get under them, and you start to read about actually how they happened. And then, every filmmaker, I think, has a narrative, has a story of how they came to actually be a professional filmmaker. And I've got mine, and it involves studying the Vietnam War from the perspective of different filmmakers and being like, oh, my God, this is a whole language. It's not just... it's not just fun at the theater. It's a whole way of expressing ideas and values. Of course, after that, just cultivating that perspective and delving as deep as I could into every aspect of it in my education and then professionally. So the short answer to your question is I think I've always been a filmmaker. Knowing that I wanted to be a professional filmmaker, I think, really became clear to me as an undergraduate.
Well, this is fascinating. You looked at the plethora of Vietnam films and you took from them what? The different perspectives from the different artists? And then what specifically did you take from that?
Well, the thing is that the films that deal with Vietnam range from, like Green Beret through to Apocalypse Now through to The Deer Hunter. And what's interesting about the way that filmmakers process the Vietnam War is that for many of them, at least initially, it was less about what was actually going on and more about how the war felt. Now, what was really, I think, at the heart of this study, though, is that the same thing was happening on the other side of the Pacific. In Vietnam, there were filmmakers, and there were filmmakers subsequent to the end of the war, who were also making films exploring what it felt like and what it looked like. And so in looking at these cultural documents, it just really became clear sort of the perspectives of the different cultures that led to this war, because, you know, hindsight is 20/20. It's really easy to look at the war and say, wow, you know, that didn't make any sense. But if you look at the cultural underpinnings, the history of the United States, its perspective as, you know, a beacon on a hill, which is something I know we all struggle with to this day. And then you look at the Vietnamese culture, which saw itself as, you know, dealing with 300, 400 years of colonialism going back to the Chinese.
Mm-hmm.
You start to see, and seeing that play out through film, you really get the personal aspect of it.
Yeah. So in terms of building your own identity as a filmmaker, and I know this is, I know you're still, you still got a long, long career ahead of you, absolutely. But do you find that there are certain themes that you're most interested in exploring?
Absolutely. I mean, what I love is the magic that's possible in the world, and the thing, when I say magic, in obviously in the case of Harrison Montgomery, it's literally magic. It's the fantastical.
Yeah.
But the experience of magic is not limited to, you know, crazy things happening or, you know, turning a chair into a talking dog. It's the wonder that we can all experience in the simple things in life. And so thematically, I'm fascinated by those things that uplift the human spirit, that lead us to wonder and marvel at all the things around us. And that really opens up a whole broad range of genres and types of stories that can explore that. But the key thing, and I think one of the challenges for particularly contemporary filmmakers in this cynical world, is to find those themes, those moments that really lead to hope.
Yeah.
You know, and not a sort of wide-eyed, I don't know what's going on, ignorant hope, but a real invested, I have committed my spirit to the experience sort of hope.
I'm with you, man. And
yeah, totally.
Something else that absolutely inspires me, stories of human connection. I mean, the person that you're passing on the street could change the course of your life in a positive way. You know, the unexpected encounters and the people that could play such a role in your life. You have to be open to that, and that produces that kind of magic that you're talking about sometimes, I think, too.
Absolutely. It sounds like you've got a lot of wisdom. We should talk later about
that. He does have a lot of wisdom, but it sounds like so do you. So, I mean...
Oh, absolutely. I'm just inspired by where you started, my friend. So tell me about this picture. I mean, this is a unique film, and we haven't... Like I said, the intro, it's not something that we've quite seen before, which is so refreshing. Was it very difficult to get off the ground?
Well, I mean, there's a creative side to it being difficult to get off the ground. There's the business side of it. And, you know, any film is difficult to get off the ground at the end of the day. In terms of the originality of the script, yeah, I think that it is a particular challenge to say, okay, this is, but it's also something that you haven't seen before. And sort of conveying that to people in the early process was a challenge. But, you know, for anybody out there who's an aspiring filmmaker or a filmmaker, I think it's a truism to say that process of exploring your film and explaining it to people makes it a better film, makes you a better filmmaker. So, you know, particularly for us, I think the film just got better and better as we went through the process of putting it together.
So that's the financial, the struggle of getting the finances put together and such. But tell me about the creative. I mean, what sparked this idea, and tell me about that journey of putting this film together.
Okay. Yeah, well, you know, and I would add to what I just said, that the challenge, the business challenge, leads to a creative opportunity. Because you have to understand your film creatively. You really have to delve into the fabric of it and make it as good as possible. And that's, you know, that's not just a business challenge, it's very much a creative challenge. The specifics for our film is that the script came in an early form to us from a director of photography we were working with, who said, oh, I happen to write. And it, you know, like so many people who say, I happen to write, you kind of roll your eyes and say, okay, yeah, I'll take a look at it. And I was thrilled. 2 months later, he delivered a script to me that had, you know, what you guys have generously pointed out is this combination of you know, human connectedness, and at the same time something different, something unique. Then, you know, it was the challenge of taking that core idea and making it accessible. And we did that through a process that took about 2 or 3 years, led first by one of my partners, Kareem Ahmed, who did the first major overhaul of the script. And the original writer is a guy named Cliff Trayman. Kareem took it on and worked painstakingly to sort of access what was at the heart of this that would make it a great yarn on top of being, you know, this subtle character study to make it something that, you know, people would sit in the theater and really invest themselves in. And then from there, Kareem and I, who have worked together, we've been creative partners for a long time, we sort of traded off, and I began the sort of final polish to the nitty-gritty of some of these key character moments so that, you know, once my voice was invested in those scenes, I'd be better able, better positioned to direct it when it came time.
Yeah. Let's talk about this cast. You have a great, great cast assembled for this. I guess we start out with Martin Landau. I mean, a legend. When did his involvement come into play?
It was pretty early on because our Los Angeles casting director, Dino Ladke, rightly identified that, you know, we had this great opportunity to have the title character be played by, you know, and it's a 70-year-old man, an 80-year-old man. So we had this great opportunity to go to somebody, a legend, somebody, one of these great names, and get them on board. And that's what we did. We went to Martin, and we were just fortunate. I mean, it's one of those things where, you know, in the course of casting a film like this, you look at, you know, 20, 30 names. I can't imagine anybody better for this part, better suited, yeah. Both in terms of his experience, but also just he embodies this guy that, you know, from my first reading of the words on the page to, you know, watching it on the screen, there's very little difference. You know, it's just, he is that guy. And so we're just very fortunate and excited to have him on.
You know, something that strikes me about him, and obviously I don't know this for certain, but watching him, I mean, he's had such a long career, and I just sense that he still has such an enthusiasm,
yeah,
for the process.
That's a great insight. I mean, that really is a terrific insight. You're spot on. You couldn't be more right. I mean, he's a guy who just loves to play.
Yeah.
He just comes out eager. It's like, and that's married to just such a command of the craft, and which,
yeah,
is, you know, incredible to watch.
And tell me about the rest of this cast. Correct me if I'm wrong in the pronunciations. I'm terrible at this. Octavio Gomez, and he is just a real find. This is the first film I think I've seen him in, and he's just incredible.
Thank you for saying that. Yeah, we were thrilled with what he did. You know, just really, really pleased. Octavio was the lead in a film called Choking Man, which played at Tribeca, I think, 2 years ago, and had a recent release. So he was he's from your neck of the woods, actually. I believe he lives in Williamsburg. But he did this film called Choking Man, where he played a painfully shy Ecuadorian dishwasher who speaks, I think, 3 words in the course of the film. And we had seen this and said, wow, you know, this guy really took on this character really well. How's that going to translate to this, to, you know, a character who has to be the hero? And when I took the meeting with him, I saw pretty clearly, pretty quickly, that he, like Martin, or like a couple of the other performers that we had in the film, just invests himself wholly. He's the type of guy that when you come to the top of a scene, which is like the top of a mountain, and you say, okay, we got to get to the bottom, he just throws himself. He just completely, you know, just like, whoo, goes for it. And that just leads to a real honesty in what he does, in what he does on the screen. And you get those great intimate moments when the camera gets really close and you just see that there's a whole life behind those eyes.
Yeah, and you talk about the fantastic Melora Walters,
yeah,
who a lot of audiences know from her performances in Magnolia is the one that automatically comes,
yeah,
to mind for me. It's just a well of emotion. She's just outstanding.
Yeah, and exactly right. I mean, that performance in Magnolia, that intensity is something that she just brings. Melora brings that to her work. And, you know, the really exciting thing is these people are great actors, and they're great people, and Melora was just there, and she was present, and she was generous, and the connection that she was able to create with Octavio leads to one of my favorite, if not my favorite, scene in the entire film. And that's completely because of the level of commitment that she brought, that Octavio brought. Again, just an honor and a pleasure to work with Melora.
You know, we're so consumed by, I'm usually so consumed by just exploring the passion behind a project, I often forget that our audience might want to know what your film is about. So if you could tell them a little bit about the story we're dealing with here.
Absolutely. It's an urban fable set in the worst neighborhood in San Francisco, arguably the worst neighborhood, the Tenderloin. It's a young guy on the run. He owes money, and he hides out in this old, dilapidated hotel where his life intersects with that of the little girl who lives next door and with the old man who lives downstairs. And he discovers a secret in the apartment of the old man, and he's forced to choose between using that secret, which is a magical secret, to save himself or to save the little girl. So it's a character drama, as we've alluded to, that explores his relationship, the Octavio, the Ricardo character, coming of age, and then explodes in a magical ending that I feel is unique, and I'm glad to hear that you guys think that as well.
It's fantastic. It's called Harrison Montgomery, and it just had its Method Fest premiere. Tell me about Method Fest and what that experience was like, the premiere the other night.
Yeah, it was really exciting because, first of all, the response was overwhelming. You know, it's just great to reach people and feel like, oh, my God, you know, what I set out to say is actually being understood. That was incredibly satisfying. The Method Fest itself is the only festival, I think, in the world, definitely in North America, that celebrates performances, that puts performances front and center. And so, you know, Martin, and the Method, by the way, is the Stanislavski Method.
Right.
The fact that Martin is the head of the West Coast branch of the Actors Studio, and the fact that you have Octavio Gomez, who's this, you know, classic Method actor, and on top of that, the fact that these performances, we're super excited about how they came out, just made it a great fit for the festival. And they were just terrific at giving us a wonderful showcase opportunity. And, you know, it was an exciting night, exciting to have the cast there, and just wonderful to see people moved by a film that we worked so damn hard on.
Yeah, that has to be the ultimate pleasure for an artist, just to be able to finally enjoy the fruits of what you labored over so long.
Yeah.
That sounds like a fantastic festival and just perfect for this film. Where are you at with it right now? Are you looking for a distributor, or what are the plans for it?
Yeah, we're in the process of going out to distributors. We have our sales agent is working on the plan as we speak, and we locked picture about 2 weeks ago, and we're just really excited. We're optimistic about what's to come, and anticipate that it'll get out there, and I think that people are really going to enjoy it.
Ultimately, what do you want them to take away from it?
From the film?
Yeah. Yeah.
I want them to see. I want them to open their eyes. I want people to feel like they've had their eyes opened by the film. The people around them, as you said, that you interact with on a daily basis, have the potential to be really important to them. You know, and part of opening your eyes is also opening your heart. And at the end of the film, I'd love people to walk out with their hearts uplifted, with a sense of the magic that's possible in the world around them. Because, again, I think that magic is possible, and that we close ourselves off to the wonderful experiences that we might have. And I think today, more than ever, you know, opportunities to just get out there and say, you know, look up, look around, engage.
Yeah.
You're right.
Well, you are absolutely speaking my language with this film. It really touched me. And please, when you have more info on the direction the release will take, please come back and join us and speak to us more. And shoot me an email at moviegeeksunited@yahoo.com. I'd love updates from you.
Yeah, happy to. And, really enjoyed talking to you guys. And the Paul Schrader piece was terrific. And,
oh, thank you.
Yeah. And
thank you. We're shaking in our boots.
Yeah, I can imagine. I can imagine. I also think that the Indiana Jones idea is a good one.
Thank you. There
cool.
you go.
I'm very excited. I mean, I watched the trailer again today, so I'm very excited.
You know, let me get your take on this, Jane.
Sure.
This on a fun note here.
Yeah.
I hear a lot of arguments about the new Indiana Jones film, and some amongst my close friends who just say he's too old.
But that's the point of the film.
No, this is my take on it. This is my take on it. Then see if you agree.
Yeah.
Why do we like Harrison Ford as an action hero, especially in that role? Because he gets punched, he bleeds, he's vulnerable, he's afraid of snakes. Isn't getting older in line with why we love that character's
yeah.
vulnerability to begin with?
Yes.
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
There you
Absolutely.
Go. There you,
couldn't
who's giving you a hard time about this?
Yeah, who are these people? We need to try.
Oh,
name.
There are a lot of naysayers out there, but I'm like wetting myself. I'm like a kid again over this
yeah.
movie.
Yeah, I mean, I pray to the film gods that the execution is there. A great team, I can't imagine it not being there, but I think that that's the only hurdle.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that there's
yeah.
any reason that an aging Harrison Ford should stand in the way of this being anything but exceptional.
I think it would
yeah.
just benefit the film, personally. But
and,
I mean,
yeah, and with Spielberg behind the lens, I mean, you're talking about someone who no one frames action like he does. No,
yeah.
no one is as exciting with the way they use the frame as he is. He's amazing.
The man is a film ninja.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. Now, are there particular filmmakers that I'm sorry, I was going to let you go, and now I'm on a hot.
Now we just started a whole
bad.
Other. This is great.
Are there particular filmmakers that you're inspired most by?
You know, there's sort of the film school aspect of it. You know, the Kubricks of the world, who I admire because it's such a command of the craft. But he doesn't make the films that I absolutely love. I mean, the contemporary stuff that Michel Gondry did in Spotless Mind is that type again. It's that wonder and just the way that he
mm-hmm.
the craft is so malleable in his hands.
He's a
and
genius.
That's awesome stuff. What's that?
He's a genius. Did you like his The Science of Sleep?
I love The Science of Sleep.
Yeah,
that's
a really good film too. I like the new one too. Be Kind, Rewind. I loved a lot too.
Yeah, there's so much playfulness in what he does.
Mm-hmm.
You know, my personal take is I'd love to see Michel Gondry pair with another screenwriter because I think that his interpretation of stuff is his strength. Of course, both those films, Be Kind, Rewind, and The Science of Sleep are terrific works.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, I'm a big advocate of the power of synergy when you get a good screenwriter together
right.
with an excellent director.
Wow, this has been a great conversation.
Yes.
Daniel, give me your last name one more time.
Davila.
Davila.
Yeah.
Davila. Daniel Davila, and remember that name because you're going to see it. You're going to see it a lot from here on out. And Daniel, you are more than welcome. Join us anytime. Call into the show anytime you'd like in the future.
Yeah, I appreciate
please
that.
Please do. Please.
Yeah, I really enjoyed it, guys.
And likewise.
Thank you so much, Dan.
Right.
Bye bye now.
Take care.
Bye bye. The new film is called Harrison Montgomery, and we will give you updates on it. It's a fantastic, magical film, and you know, it gets you inspired about movies again. Occasionally, you need a movie like that.
I think everything we've talked about tonight. It's that theme. It gets you excited about movies tonight. It's been a really good show.
I think so, too.
I mean, it's been
surprisingly good. And the thing that we thought it was going to suck when we first started.
I didn't think it was just...
No, we didn't. We didn't
know how it's
going to
turn out sometimes and how an interview will go. And everything just went so smooth tonight and in such unexpected directions. It was great.
You know what? I think hold true in the power of people that are passionate about what they do.
Right. Mm-hmm.
That's all we need, and we're off and running. You know, there's nothing better for us. Guys, thanks for joining us in the chat room. Like we said, we'll be with you Sunday with a whole new show, and we're going to take some Wednesdays and the last Sunday off before the 16th, which is the date when we bring you our one-year anniversary. You don't want to miss this.
You
man.
Don't want to
it's
miss
It's like
this.
Catching up to our archive of 80-plus shows in one night.
There you go.
It's unbeatable. Please give us a comment, give us a rating, make sure it's a comment we can understand. And we've just enjoyed the hell out of bringing the show to you tonight.
Yes.
We'll see you next week.
See you next week. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye now. If you want to make an impact online, GoDaddy.com has what you need.
Indiegogo.com names as low as $1.99, plus world-class hosting, fast and easy website builders, and much more. Plus, as a listener of Movie Geeks United, you just have to enter the code MovieGeeks, that's MovieGeeks, upon checkout, and you'll save an additional 10% on any order. Some restrictions apply. See site for details. Get your piece of the internet at GoDaddy.com.